Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I want to start this conversation this evening by sharing a couple of conversations. Every conversation is always embedded in a relationship, and every relationship is embedded in a context, and every context is embedded in a long and evolving history. So if I started by telling you the history, and then the context, and then the relationship, and then the conversation, I wouldn't get past my first page. So this evening I'm going to start with three conversations that are a little window into the life of a peace builder. And as I finish each of these, I would like to take just a few seconds to let them soak and to have you take a little pause and to ask yourself the question, if you were in my shoes in that conversation at that moment, what might you say? September 1987. Anything else? The minister was ending our meeting. Yes, I heard myself saying. One more thing. I had a message and a request I had carried from Costa Rica to Nicaragua. Unwritten, the words were plastered on the soul of a painful conversation. Only days before, one of the most significant, though quite controversial, revolutionaries, a defector from the Sandinista movement, had spent an evening in our home. He had heard the offers of amnesty announced by the government. Exiles who wished to return, no matter their offense or their status, would be accepted back without fear of reprisal, legal or military, as long as they put down their weapons. Time has come to go home, he had said. But I have doubts they will agree. There are, and here he paused for a moment, mistakes, you know. No wounds are worse than those received in the house of a friend. Can you ask him? Now standing before the powerful head of the Ministry of the Interior, I heard myself describe the conversation, the person, and the request. Comandante, he wants to come home, but he needs some assurance. Would you have something to tell him? Silence seemed to last longer than I could remember experiencing in this office that had become a space for negotiation and talking peace. Yes, the comandante finally responded. You tell that son of a bitch that he will rot in the worst of all hells, the hell of nobody remembers you. January 9, 1993. In the distance, we could hear the rumbling din of a crowd as we left the airport and traveled in the back of a pickup truck toward the outskirts of Hargeisa, Somaliland. As we passed the edge of town, at times the noise seemed to grow, shouts and screams sounding more like a mob than a meeting. We had few details. We had just arrived. We only knew it was dangerous. Fighting was about to break out. Our hosts were visibly shaken. Plans for the afternoon had changed. They spoke in low voices of some troubles with local imams. By evening, the specifics emerged. Five women had been accused of adultery. No men were apparently caught in the act. On the heels of a brutal dictatorship and disintegrating political chaos, clan-based violence and warfare had given rise to sporadic violence and more fundamentalistic expression of Islam, much more fundamentalistic, that had promised restoration in that part of Somalia. Our plane had touched down at the height of an impromptu court making their way to the stoning grounds. High-pitched, righteous fever carried the day. The women were buried to their necks, their heads barely above ground. Crying for mercy, they begged to be heard. They cried that they were not guilty. A young boy threw the first stone, and then clouds of rocks flew until the cries ended. Late that evening, a handful of women arrived at our host's house. It was risky to even talk with foreigners, but they needed a sense of assurance, a connection to the outside. They retold the story in vivid detail, having watched it from the edge of the crowd. Tears streamed down their faces. Fear reverberated in their shaking bodies. They pleaded for help. April 24, 1995. Before you start, I have just one question. He looked around the room and then back to focus on us, his visitors. Why do you think violence doesn't work? The H Block commander took a seat across from us in a chair. We sat crunched on the underside of a bunk bed, legs dangled just above me on my right. In a sparse room made for a couple of lifers, we had 15 pairs of eyes watching our every move. It was my first visit to the Maze prison in Northern Ireland. Three mediators and a room full of loyalist paramilitaries. This created an unusual break in their day, but it made for an intense atmosphere. I felt myself wheeze in a quick breath. We had barely arrived in the room, had barely spoken our names, and then that question. I had the urge to turn to Brendan or Joe and laughingly say, "Why don't you guys take this one?" When the commander's hand raised to draw a silence and attention back to him, he was not finished. "And before you answer, I have a story," he went on. "A few months back, we had some troubles with the prison superintendent here. He didn't like some things we said and did. So one fine day, he decided that this year we would not receive our annual family Easter baskets. We found this totally unacceptable. We protested. We ask in writing for a change of policy. We ask for a meeting. We ask for negotiations. But nothing would change his mind. So we bid our time and waited. Just prior to Easter, an opportunity presented itself. We grabbed a few of the guards when they opened the H Block gate. We force jammed the gate shut. We dragged them back to the end of this corridor. We took them into the showers. We stripped them naked and we beat them to a pulp and threw them back out through the door. The whole place got shut down for a while, but you know what? Our Easter baskets are back." He paused, story finished, looked me square in the eyes. "Now, tell me why you think violence doesn't work." If you found yourself flipping between ideas and responses or drawing a complete blank about what you might have said, don't worry. In a book I have started, I just compiled about a dozen or 15 of these stories in the opening chapter titled Speechless Memoirs. For me, these vignettes were intensely lived dilemmas. They stick with me like a scene from a movie that you've seen too many times, but every time it comes up, you just can't help but watch once again. They've embedded themselves in my consciousness because they stopped me short. They constitute what I call the "Oh my God" moment. In spite of finding some words to externalize in the moment itself, the experience of these conversations left me profoundly speechless, mute. Oh my God moments create a vivid reminder that our lives unfold with multiple layers of meaning. At one level, we were carrying out a conversation focused on some content or process or problem that seemed immediately apparent and urgent. And at other levels, we suddenly realize that there are other layers of meaning unfolding below and beyond this visible surface. This evening, I would like to explore this challenge of the below and the beyond. Before I go there, however, I need to make a few introductory comments about some key words in the title of this talk, which you see up here. I actually am not sure what I was thinking when I gave this title. I am in the very early process of trying to write a book about these topics, and I'm still in the exploration phase, which means I'm sorting through my own confusion. So this basically tonight is an invitation for you to join my confusion. I can't accomplish everything that this title suggests in the minutes that we have together. So I will only begin by giving you a few thoughts on some key words, starting in inverse order. And the latter part of my time, I want to come to this first part of the title of Compassionate Presence. Violence. Over the past 30 years, I have witnessed and walked in and through some rather tough and bitter conflicts. You may have noticed in the conversations, the vignettes that I just shared, that that was the case. I guess what I wanted to say with this phrase, in the face of violence, is that I have been in close proximity and with people who have suffered from and have participated in a good bit of violence. In a recent book that my daughter and I worked on together, we began to explore the impact of deep violation, particularly on people from local communities who have to come through it often in waves or cycles. We started noticing how in very different kinds of places, certain phrases or words kept jumping up when people spoke of the hard journey to heal from what they were experiencing and continue to experience. Phrases like, I have no voice. I have no sense of home. I felt so lost. I struggled to know who I even am. I'm just trying to feel like a person again. We noted these metaphoric layers and started noticing other people's language and how it had parallel. For example, this often used phrase of internally displaced persons, IDPs, which if you work in the international community, you know means people who are displaced by violence. If they leave the country, they become refugees. If they stay within their home country, they become IDPs, internally displaced people. When we were talking with people, what they conveyed was the sense that it is deeply a sensation of being internally displaced. A sense that I have lost my root, my home, my meaning. My daughter worked for a period of time with young women who had been kidnapped during Liberian or Sierra Leone wars out into the bush and became essentially the slaves of the commanders locally. Very difficult in terms of their own identity, motherless mothers who often watched the death of their mother in the kidnapping and who became a mother in the bush attached to one of the commanders that had kidnapped them. Victims who also perpetrated violence. And in the period after the war, the process of restoration and recuperation, how? She noted something that others have noted about violence. It's very significant. Whenever they were interviewed and began to tell their story, they told it in a very flat, monotone voice. There is no language that we have reserved to speak the unspeakable. And violence inevitably enters the world of the unspeakable. So here are a few thoughts on violence. Violence numbs. The search to heal is a search to feel again. Violence uproots and removes voice. The search to heal is a search to belong again, to be in touch with a sense of personhood, to be an author, not a victim. Violence damages the essence of humanity. The search to heal is a search to find a way through brokenness, to feel safe and part of a community of care. Violence destroys the capacity to feel and see beauty. The search to heal is a search to somehow recapture awe, wonder, and hope. And violence lives well beyond the statistics that count the number dead. Thoughts on faith. Peter Berger has suggested that we live in a furiously religious world. We do. Religion and faith have been expressed in ways that bring forward the very best of shared humanity and have contributed to and at times justified the very worst of violence. Many of the settings where I have worked, religious identity and notions of spiritual truth are contested. The contesting creates and drives fear, projection, protectionism, exclusivity, and quite often justifies violence. A prevalent fear is this: if your version of the truth prevails, mine will die. A lot of talk happens in these settings, but not much listening. More often than not, a sense of in-group security is created by constructing a clear image of an enemy who opposes and wishes to destroy our truth. We know who they are by projecting a clear sense of who we are not and who it is that wishes us harm. The devil is in the details, and here is the main detail. The devil is in their camp, not ours. In this world of holy justification and dangerous devils, some people despair of faith and disparage religion. I must confess that I have many more questions now than when I first started this work. I guess you could say that in reference to faith, I am less certain of the certainties I once had. Though I must also say that living in the face of violence alongside people of extraordinary courage has deepened my faith. I don't see the fact that I have less certainty to mean that I have less faith. For me, faith is not about quantity and certainty. It's about essence. If you know my writing, it's about the haiku thing. Jesus, I think, called it a mustard seed. So here is my mustard seed. A few guideposts I have found meaningful for a person of faith engaged in peace building. Offer what you hope to receive from others. Honest transparency. This mostly means be yourself. Be open. Be curious. Know that truth unfolds endlessly. Prepare to peer into your own deepest understanding of truth by way of windows offered in the lives, understandings, and experiences of others, even those who believe very differently than you. Sometimes those are the greatest windows into our own understanding. Deep truth sharing and searching of the honest kind that I'm referring to require trust. Trust comes with friendship and time. This is particularly true in settings where friendship and truth emerge across violent religious divides. So find a friend if you're interested in looking for truth. Make sure it's not one who thinks just like you. Share faith when asked, and listen to the other as if God is speaking to you. Compassionate presence. I am currently in a writing process, a book, I hope, on this topic. For me, it has a deeply personal side and has been nudged by, I suppose, the inquisitiveness of a practitioner and scholar and teacher. But right now, it is in wild gestation, rambling ideas that are seeking some coherence. On the personal side, these themes became more open and significant during and after a period in my life when I came through a near-death experience. A car wreck that I barely survived in the Basque Country with badly crushed rib cages on both sides. The experience literally took my breath away completely, and it stopped me dead in my tracks. Hospitalization, months of near complete dependence on others, and then the slow winding and unwinding process of healing. In this time, I became aware, as never before, of my own fragile and precious humanity. I experienced moments of compassion, love, and care in how people around me held and provided for me. From a night nurse who went the extra mile when I couldn't move, or my wife, Wendy, and her unending patience and encouragement through the recovery. Some days I dipped so low I lost sight of everything. Minutes felt like years. I experienced for the first time in my life a feeling of overwhelming powerlessness. There was nothing I could do, and certainly nothing I could control. I felt things I could not express. Words failed me. I had fallen into the world of the unspeakable. This precipitated in my life a period of very deep questions. It has been nearly 15 years since then, and these questions have not gone away. They are questions without answers about life, about vocation, about my place in the world. What I experienced in those years also sparked a curiosity about care, compassion, and presence. Compassion arrived by way of people who had, if you will, their hearts in their hands. Angels of sorts who in moments of urgent need noticed and then reached out to help me. They responded to something I needed and that I could not provide for myself. At the same time, I experienced something deeper than the act of the doing, a sensation of connection embedded in the somewhere and the somehow of who they were as people. I still have very few words to express this, the best I can offer. I sensed their presence. I sensed them sensing my humanity and holding it with care. This is something that I experienced as deeply sacred. It went below and beyond words to express. I have found this to be a very intriguing image of peace-building presence. The arching physical bridge stretches to reach and hold two shores in relationship. So this is what you see above. The reflection, if you look here, the reflection moving and shimmering in the water completes nearly a full circle with the bridge. This is what Parker Palmer calls the hidden wholeness. Let me try the same from the angle of poetry and go to Northern Ireland to Seamus Heaney, whose famous lines from The Cure of Troy appeal to this similar kind of imagination. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a farther shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Much of our work in peace building focuses on how do we build this bridge that holds the farther shore together with the near shore. I have found in my own work in life that we have not attended as much to this, the hidden wholeness. How do we incite this thing that Friedman calls the nature of our presence? I have been trying to explore this, and I do it primarily through a couple of things that I think form, for lack of a better term, I'm using the word, the arts. The first one that I'd like to share is the art of noticing, or what we might call awareness. I think compassion begins not with the sensation of feeling the suffering. I'll come to that in a minute. The feeling the suffering of another. I think compassion begins when we notice. When we notice what we could perhaps call the humanity of the other. We see a fellow human being. This, I think, has something to do with actually seeing. And I think it has something deeply to do with respect. So here's your, I'm going to give you a small Latin lesson tonight on several words. Here's my first one. I love etymology. And I love figuring out where words came from. The word respect. The word respect is built in Latin from re, which is over again, repeat, and spacere, which is to see. So respect means that you look once, and then you turn and look again. And in the looking again, you see something that you had not noticed initially. To look again, respecere, opens a space of awareness. Our Buddhist colleagues would likely refer to this as mindfulness. I have been working at this in my training and education efforts. And I've devised a series of little exercises that are kind of goofy, to be real honest with you, because they require people to do things that we don't do much. They require us to take the time to actually sit and notice what's around us. The artist Frederick Frank called this the Zen of seeing. He approached it through the angle that was essentially his view that drawing was a form of meditation. I have done it more through poetry. So let me give you an example. I'll give you two. In my classes, I've been taking people out of the classroom and onto the sidewalks of our campuses. I got perplexed about this when we first were starting the program at Eastern Mennonite University about 18, 20 years ago. And to be approved by the recommending boards that approve master's degrees, we had to receive a certification. To receive our certification, we had people that came out and looked carefully whether we were worthy of such a thing. And one of their questions was, how many seat hours do you have for each class that you teach? And after they left, this bothered me very significantly for a long time, because I had to wonder who, if we listed them, were the five greatest teachers in the whole history of humanity. You might just go down through them. They might be the Greeks, they might be Jesus, they might be Buddha. You could list to Muhammad, you have a whole range of them. And I guarantee you this, that if you look carefully at how they taught by walking. They walked with people, and as they walked, they talked. And as they walked and talked, they noticed. And as they noticed, they took account. And as they saw, they began to learn. This was not seat hours. There's no scientific proof that you learn better seats through the back end of your body than you do in walking. Now, I've become a very firm believer in this walking notion, so I actually take my classes on walks. Sometimes we walk single file. We look very, very funny, especially on the campus of the University of Notre Dame, which is a very sophisticated research campus. And I tell all the students when we go out, you have two disciplines. The first is I'm going to ask you to pay attention to maybe one of your senses for the next half hour, just one. And the other is I want you to ignore everybody looking at you. Neither of these are easy to do. But we walk single file out, we walk single file back, and then for about 15 minutes, without lifting pen from paper, they try to describe everything that they just felt cross their cheek, as an example. Or everything that they heard as another example. How little notice we take of the beauty and that which surrounds us. The front end, I think, of compassion starts with the noticing. I've landed on another word that I work with this. You may have noticed my interest in poetry. It's poiesis. Poiesis is the Greek word, and for me what became a huge revelation was to actually find that this Greek word appeared in the New Testament, and it appears in the phrase, blessed are the peacemakers. And it's the maker portion of that phrase that is located. Poiesis means in Greek to craft artistically, to work, to do. So a more proper translation of that text might have been, blessed are those who poetically craft peace. Now, this act of poiesis is always an act of creation, and I think there's something that links between noticing and creativity. And it's a thing that's not always easily developed, but it has some interesting roots. For example, Saint Benedict, what was his first guidepost? His first guidepost to his followers, his order. They have to learn to listen with the ear of the heart. That was his first guidepost. To learn to listen with the ear of the heart. The second, attunement, the art of staying in touch. A lot of authors, when I've been reading books about compassion, and one of the things that shocked me was to find how few books about compassion have been written in our field of peace building. So I'm trying to figure out why we haven't done that. But a lot of those who do write from different traditions often emphasize that compassion is about feeling or being in touch with the suffering of another person. This feeling moves us to action. But these feelings can be a tricky thing. We may find it useful to go to the notion that Clifford Geertz once used for describing ethnography in the work of an anthropologist, that we need not a thin description, but a thick description. So maybe it would be useful to talk about thin feeling and thick feeling. Because many of the authors warn against thin feeling. They don't use that term, that's mine. And what they warn against is that feelings can move quickly and be very superficial, and that when we feel the tug at the heart of the dilemma of another, we may experience some form of pity or sympathy or even empathy, but this may have a kind of a fleeting, transient element to it, and that in our action, we're trying to relieve our own sense of the difficulty of experiencing that, which may be a way that we release guilt, may be a way that we release an intense sense that it has touched a suffering in us, but it may not be for truly being with the suffering of another. And that, of course, is the beginning and the root of this word. Compassion in Latin is with, pati, suffering. With suffering. That pati, by the way, is a similar word to the one that forms the word patience. So we might suggest that compassion could add a little dose of saying it stays with suffering. Not physically, perhaps, but increases an ability to live with this notion that we haven't just seen the suffering and want to quickly get past it, but that we hold a space in which we are with that person. A first impulse, as may, and it may be a good one, is that quite often we seek some kind of a response to the suffering. We want to fix it. But this may not be thick compassion. It may, in fact, alleviate our need to get past the suffering that we feel in a moment. The interesting root of the notions of compassion that we find in the Greek and the Hebrew languages locate compassion in a different part of the body. It's not about a head level. In Greek, it's about the entrails, the guts. You feel in your guts. In Hebrew, it's related to the womb. Compassion is located in the womb. And I think thick compassion has something to do with this gut level. And in some instances, staying with an uncomfortable sensation. I would like to suggest that compassion requires us to stay in touch. There are ways that we can come at that. Let me go for a moment to the two words that came up on that second line. Because if we went back to our bridge metaphor, one aspect of the bridge is our side of that divide. And if we begin to look at our side, I would like to suggest two words that I have found helpful that I'm still trying to find ways to practice. The first is the word sincerity. You know, I did my doctoral dissertation in Central America, and I did it based on the language of local people and how they responded to an experience to conflict. And I noticed over and again how often people said that what was required was that people had to be sincere. Sincero. Or as the case may be, sincera. And I never fully got that until some years later, I understood where this word came from. So let me tell you a little story from the Roman Empire. This word traces back to the period of the great construction in marble. And you can imagine all the empire being built with all its massive buildings, that they needed a lot of good granite and marble. So people who were sellers of stones had a pretty good market. And when they sold a big piece of marble, if they wanted to really make a great case for how good it was, they needed to cover up its defects. And they did so by placing wax into various cracks. And so at some point, people would find after they purchased that block of marble that it had too many defects to work with, that they had been tricked. And so they said, what we need are people who sell marble seen cera, without wax. That's the root of the word sincere. To live in the world without wax. Vulnerability. Now, vulnerability we also seem to bring over into the area of one of two things. Weakness, unprotected, perhaps, sometimes gullible. If you're vulnerable, you're going to get taken advantage of. The word trace is actually in Latin in this case, vulneris, is the word for wound. And if you wanted to recast or reframe the notion of vulnerability, I would suggest that what it means is to carry a wound gracefully. And I think this is a starting point on this side of that bridge that tries to cross over, and this is part of what is under the wholeness that shimmers in the water. It is about sincerity, being who you are without falsehoods. And it's about vulnerability, offering and carrying your own wounds gracefully. For me, this has a lot to do with staying in touch. It has a lot to do with coming back to the notions that we may then begin to understand about the womb, a space that does provide for growth, that surrounds and holds, that in some ways creates where it is that creativity can happen. And I think it is in those spaces and from these kinds of contexts that we begin the process of small doses of compassion. This is one of the ideas I'm playing with, so it's a very nascent idea. I'm not sure it's going to hold, but let's try it. I don't think compassion takes care of everything. I think what it does is we experience it in doses, and it touches our humanity. And in so doing, it helps to, in small ways, begin a process of inoculation against fear, against isolation, against enmity. We go to my third one because I'm nearing the end of this of my time period. Alongsideness, the art of befriending. My mentor that I mentioned earlier, Adam Curl, who came from Quaker tradition, was the only person that I have found that actually used this word consistently to describe mediation. He said mediation requires that you befriend people who are enemies. It's not cited in the literature very much. It's hard to find anywhere, to be honest. Maybe it was a little too Quakerly. Adam defined it pretty much at face value. He would say you are basically with people in a way of friendship. You approach them, and these are his cited words in one of his books in the middle. You approach them with respect and liking. Those are his words. My own feeling is that the art of befriending has a couple of elements that are worth some exploration. You don't have to go much further for your own view on this to think about your own friendships. I think friendship is about enjoying and caring for each other. I also think it has a lot to do with humility And I have three kinds of humility I'd like to mention. The first is the root word of humility, which is H-U-M-U-S, that we sometimes call hummus, which is also like the stuff that you recycle into the garden. It is earthy. It is earthy. My own sense is that friendship begins when we are with another person in a down-to-earth way. You'll notice how these seem to reverberate back to some of the things that I've been talking about. But I think where we have real friends, we feel a sense of being able to simply be ourselves. We're down to earth. Now, this, of course, is not easy to do in the middle of a conflict or when you're with the Minister of the Interior. But how do you bring to bear the notion that you are bringing your full person, who you are? Second aspect of humility, I think, has to do, and here I would like to return to something I mentioned earlier. Humility is not about being above as in superior, ahead as in knowing the way, or behind as in pushing. Humility, I think, has a real sense. In fact, it may be that we come low, we get right down to the ground level. There's actually a sense in which humility is about lowering, that we are, in essence, alongside, this term that I would like to use. By the way, my spell check hates this alongsideness term. It's not yet appeared, apparently, in any dictionary, so caution if you use it in papers for those of you who are students. What I wanted to say about this particular component is what I think is the depth of this notion that if compassion is about the thin side, okay, the thin side would be pity or sympathy or even empathy or providing a fix or a response, fixing something. It's often with a view that I, the healthy one, extend my help to the unhealthy. This humility would say, we carry our wounds gracefully. We feel and see the suffering because we have ourselves suffered. We are, in essence, to use the words of Henry Nouwen, a wounded healer. And I think one of the tricks of this term, compassion, is about how quickly it may translate to ways of unequal relationship and superiority. So it provides us for a great challenge. The third element is I think humility has a lot to do with truth seeking, and here our context of religious contesting religious truth becomes so critical. My own view is that humility is one of the few safeguards that we may have to help us remember that we have not yet arrived. And that if we feel we have arrived and we have arrived at the truth, we move from humility to arrogance. Even if we are firmly convicted and we don't think that we're doing that, I believe that the humility that's required is for an unending search for truth, because I believe truth is big. And I only perceive, as Paul would say, through a dark glass dimly, what this bigness might mean. Final little note about befriending. Presence. It's not only being with in a particular moment, it's about having well-worn paths. I can't say enough about my particular view that we too much conceive of a lot of our peace building and conciliation, mediation kinds of work as a kind of a offering of a service that's in and out, in which befriending is hard to fit. I have often considered it from my angle as actually committing to friendship. How long, you might ask? I have one of those that's in its 22nd year. And it took 18 years before they asked me to do anything. Well-worn paths. It's a little phrase that comes from the meaning that friends have well-worn paths that reach each other's doorsteps. I hear a lot of complaint in places that I'm in that nobody's paying attention, nobody's coming, they aren't listening. This is a thing that's frustrating to a lot of people. So I have tried to make a commitment to both listening but also to regularity of contact. I discovered early on I couldn't do that in very many places. That was a hard lesson. So I made increasing a commitment to do longer times in fewer places. Conclusions. Let me return for a moment to our opening stories and vignettes, and back to this little painting of the bridge that I'll leave up now. What I've discovered in class whenever I shared a few of these stories, and one or two of these I have on occasion done just to elicit a conversation with students, inevitably, the students want to know, well, what did you say to the Minister of the Interior? What did you say to the commander in the maize prison? What did you say to the women in the candlelit room in the darkness of that night in Hargeisa? I always find this an interesting thing because obviously what people want to know is, what's my approach and technique? Can we learn something here that we would apply? There must be some brilliance in the way that this person arrived at the way they shifted the conversation to make something move and shape. And we all would like to think that we are good conversationalists. And then in the moment we might come up with something that would touch this context in a different way. But I notice that the questions don't always find their way to attend to that hidden wholeness. They want to know about the open side of it. Well, some words did come in each case. With the minister, I remember that Gustavo Parajon, my colleague, and I appealed to his own proclamation that he had said just recently the time had come to heal the nation. Maybe it would be good to think about what healing the nation would mean. And I think we said something about that it's never easy to find a way home. With the commander in the maize prison, we ended up talking quite a bit that afternoon about the peace process and his fear of what was coming with the peace process. But it was clear after several back and forths that the commander who opened with that line, "Tell us why you think violence doesn't work," had absolutely no interest in talking about violence. What he wanted, I think, at a much deeper level, he wanted to check out who we were. He was testing. He wanted to know if we were coming to judge, to lecture. He wanted to know if we would have the ears to hear the heart of a hard life. I have to say that unfortunately, for the most part, I probably failed my own compassion exam that particular day. With the women in Hargeisa, we could not find adequate words. To be honest, all I remember is that we sat and cried. I did write poems about two of these experiences. And it's been about 20 years that I've had those in a file that I carry with me. I read them privately to myself on a pretty regular basis. The poems remind me of these friends, of their faces. It's the primary way that I pray. Let me conclude with saying that I think in peace building, inevitably, we are exposed to demanding egos. We're exposed to people who are seeking meaning, trying to exert their voice, but often in the pain of conflict, they're doing that from lived insecurity and fear. And often the way their egos respond is in ways to protect themselves, to hold on to defending and blaming as the way that they can handle the difficulties of what they've experienced. I also know that peace building places us in close proximity with a significant amount of suffering and trauma. I have noticed this about these two things in my life. Damaged egos and trauma affect my spirit and my soul. I have seen it over and again. I think compassionate presence and peace building requires that we cultivate a kind of a resiliency to courageously face this outpouring of ego in the midst of conflict without replicating its anxious dynamics, and that we nurture the listening heart to live alongside deep trauma without taking over responsibility for healing others. In both instances, compassion suggests a commitment to alongsideness that provides a different quality of presence. This quality of presence, I think, requires open vulnerability, but not gullible weakness. Boundless love with clarity of boundaries. And listening for the fragile voice of truth and choosing to live by that truth without arrogance or imposition. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.